What's up? Welcome to Swan Signal Live. Want to take it over, John?
That's right. New official co-host over here. You already let me know that it's gotten to my head. I'm going to try to keep that in mind. My head is this big. You guys let me know if it's getting a little too big for the screen. Great to be here. We're missing Brady. It is August. He deserves a vacation. He's taking just a few days off, unlike the central bankers who take the entire month of August off. Brady's going to take a few days off. It's well-deserved. And it just leaves the four of us figuring out, is there actually a tariff on gold? We literally can't figure it out. We'll try to get to the bottom of that and many other things, as I've said, but I think it's worth repeating. I don't remember the last slow news week for Bitcoin. Like, there's just always stuff to uncover for a long, long time. So we got at least a half dozen very interesting stories to talk about here, probably more quick hits to cover as well. So pumped to get into it with you guys. Brady should be back next week, but we got a great crew here. So I'll say what's up to Alec. How's the week going so far, man?
Fantastic, man. Super busy. Got to mention, love the new intro music for Swan Signal. That was great.
It's funky. Nice.
Yeah.
Little funk. Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. Q, how you doing, man? I feel like you got to show off the swag that you're wearing as well.
Shout out Real Bedford. You know, we got soccer season next weekend. Everything kicks off. You know, I'm just getting ready for it.
Is that your number one sport that you follow?
Soccer and basketball for sure.
Okay.
And then, you know, fantasy football strictly because I'm a degenerate.
need like a little bit of a link to the NFL. I get it. I do like a pick'em league just so I have like something. But it's harder for me to follow too much these days between family and Bitcoin podcasts. You got to get the 40 hours per weekend. It just doesn't leave that much for pro sports.
40 hours of Bitcoin podcast per week. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. What other 40 hours per week are we talking about?
I don't know. Like minimum of work.
We include that as work. That's all for work.
Oh, that's proof of work.
Okay. So that's how you guys get out of so much of the meetings that we're supposed to be in. Got it.
Sorry, I can't make that meeting. I've blocked out my calendar to listen to 6 hours straight of Bitcoin podcasts.
That's why everyone has like these busy blocks on their calendars whenever I try to throw meetings on them. Noted. Yeah. See, this is the new guy for you. New guy's still figuring it out.
I mean, we're joking, but only at a company like Swan could that actually potentially be a legitimate excuse.
Totally.
All right, nice. Hurley, you wanted anything else you wanted to chime in with before we start hitting the topics here?
Yeah, no, just just lots of stuff going on every single week. And I'm just speaking of watching content as part of my job. That's kind of part of my job, is to just be looking at Bitcoin news all the time and looking for clips and everything. It's amazing. I'm blessed, man. It's awesome. Bitcoin is pretty much front and center for everything. So let's dive into it.
For sure, man. Yep. And you, how many shows did you record this week, or your daily?
Well, I do two shows.
Not quite daily anymore. So it's two shows a week is the cadence now, right?
Yeah. Daily would absolutely kill me. It would be too much.
Yeah.
Whoa. P and I did it for like a year. Yeah, straight. But
you guys did a live show where it was like, if we just did this once a day and just chatted about Bitcoin for an hour, I'd be like, okay. I mean, obviously there's prep involved. Okay. I'm not saying it's easy.
Clearly the live show has like a downgrade in Hurley's eyes. Noted. I will remember this.
It's a different beast though. With
P and I are going to have a talk with Hurley after this.
Hurley's production quality on his videos is immaculate. That takes time and effort.
Thank you. Yeah. It's, it comes from, because a lot of people are surprised that I'm able to do it all myself, but it's become like, I came from like 17 years being an editor, like a professional editor for TV, film, documentaries. So I'm like super fast at, if we didn't have that, we would have to have like a couple days or some editor to step in to do it. So I'm able to kind of just like do it all in one go. And it takes me like a couple hours of prep, record, an hour or two to edit and publish. So
nice.
It's quick. Yeah. What's
the line? It's like, I would have written a shorter message to you, but I didn't have the time. It's like condensing it down into the most important stuff, plus adding the production value and making it entertaining and clean and the transitions and everything.
And also at making it digestible for a YouTube audience, which has been a learning experience for me over the past couple of years.
Right.
What works on YouTube, because it's very different from, you know, coming from the world that I came from. So just making it pop on YouTube without being too clickbaity, because that's a little bit off-putting as well.
Yeah. Before we get into the headlines, can you elaborate on that a little bit, what you mean about making it pop for a YouTube audience?
Well, basically just making like the title, the combination of the title, the thumbnail are key. And then obviously your first like 15, 20 seconds of your video is also key. Obviously you want your whole video to be good, but there's like this secret sauce of getting everything to line up perfectly so that people see it. They want to watch it. They click it. They don't just watch it for 5 seconds and go away. They want to continue watching it. And also just like topics that people on YouTube tend to go for, especially if we want to grow and we want more people to learn about Bitcoin, it's usually number go up. So a lot of times there's like price related stuff, but I always try to loop in some like Bitcoin education in there so that they're not just learning about, oh, Bitcoin's going to make you rich or Bitcoin number go up. It's also like, this is why we Bitcoin, really. Right. So that's what I aim for.
Wait, so Bitcoin isn't going to make us rich?
No, it's not going to make us get poor slowly. Remember, it's not a get rich quick scheme. It's a don't get poor slowly scheme.
I love that, man. No, that makes total sense. And yeah, you have to play to the algorithms platform that you're publishing on. I think that's just the reality. You can't ignore that. But to your point, there is a limiting factor there. You don't want it to just be those people with the wide open mouths and their eyes are super bright and
a million.
The green arrow is going like this. And like, you know, you can't sacrifice your credibility just to maximize all that stuff.
Yeah. You take a little bit of that, like, you know, even like the BitBoys. I remember when I first got into it, BitBoy was like growing like crazy, but instead of the like complete noise in his videos, you replace that with Signal and you like, so you're grabbing people and you're teaching them truth about Bitcoin and Signal. Then it's like, you get the best of both worlds.
There is no more ridiculous character to or human being to see live in person at a Bitcoin conference than BitBoy. Like the strut he walks around with, his attire.
Oh, I've never you've met him at a Bitcoin conference.
I have interviewed him at a Bitcoin conference.
Nice. I interviewed this.
I did it 2024. I interviewed him.
What? That what? Recently?
I thought he was in jail at that point.
No, I did it at the Nashville conference. We did like a short, I was doing a roaming camera interview and I saw him and I was like, guys, we need to interview BitBoy. Like, I want to see how crazy I can like rile him up. And it was like a 10 minute interview and the camera guy and the producer behind was like, kill it, kill it, kill it. And I wouldn't let up. I kept egging him on and he was not happy with me by the end of that.
Are you sure in between you there wasn't a thick pane of glass when you were conducting this?
No,
interview?
This was like, we were literally like,
it wasn't through a phone like, that you had to pick up and talk through glass. Okay.
No.
If you followed him from the beginning, it was like the perfect trajectory of like why you don't shitcoin. Why you don't get into crypto. It's like,
or just like, I don't know,
downfall. And it's like, you got to feel bad for the guy, man. It was like,
why you don't take drugs
and why you don't take drugs.
Both. A lot of takeaways there. A lot of takeaways. A
lot of good lessons. Yeah.
All right, cool. Let's that's enough intro banter here. Let's get into it. Hurley, I'll let you kind of run the graphics and stuff, but I think the biggest one, which I think is the title of the show here. So here's the ABC News is even picking up this one. I like that we use this graphic to show that the mainstream media is even reporting on this. So headline here for our audio only people is Trump opens the door for private equity and crypto as 401k retirement plan options. So I definitely want to hear from you guys on this. You know, add in whatever stats, interpretations you think are appropriate here. I'll give my TLDR summary. This is medium to long-term bullish, no doubt. I think anyone who's expecting this to get incorporated into your 401k plans offering like next week or next month, you know, you're being a little too short-term bullish on this one. Just my own little bit of research here about kind of what timeline we might see for this. I think it's going to be some month window where the plans themselves, work with the regulators to figure out, you know, how they do this properly, what offerings they actually give to their clients. There's going to be some due diligence involved. So it's probably like, I mean, I'll just throw a ballpark figure out here. Don't take this too literally, anybody, but like, I still think it's going to be like a year or two before you actually see 401k plans that say like, yeah, you've got, you know, the Bitcoin ETFs right here. So that's my quick take, but what do you guys think?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Alec.
I pulled this up. They put out a fact sheet, and you know, the order really just directs the Secretary of Labor to re-examine the guidance on fiduciary duties regarding alternative assets. So these 401k plans, right? They have specific rules for fiduciary duties they must follow. What investments are available in these vehicles, because they are retirement plans and they want them to be responsible, right? So that's kind of the first step, is to re-examine what are the existing rules, how can they be modified. And yeah, I agree, it's going to take quite a long time for anything to change there. I know in my experience, so I was brought on to Swan to really head the IRA team initially. So I spent a lot of time dealing with retirement plans in general. So by the way, if you have retirement plans, Bitcoin is available. 401ks are just a unique employer-sponsored plan that really keeps you boxed in while you're employed. But as soon as you terminate employment, you can move to what's called an IRA, an individual retirement account, which has a lot more flexibility, where you can move to providers like Swan to capture Bitcoin with those retirement funds using the same tax-advantaged type accounts, traditional and Roth IRAs. So it's something that people have been doing for years. There's plenty of options out there, but this is going to enable, while people are trapped in that 401k box, which is, you know, upwards of $9 trillion worth of value in these account types. They're extremely popular. I definitely know more people that have a 401k than an IRA. You know, IRAs are really limited too. You can only put in like $7,000 each year into these accounts, where 401ks are about triple, if not more. They're like $23,000 or so you can stick into those. So I definitely think it's a material impact when that change happens. And I believe in people having the freedom to, you know, choose what their investments are. Even if there is some crypto options there, I would hope people are getting education, watching Swan Signal, and learning not to go into crypto assets and buy Bitcoin. Yeah, I think it's overall a great thing, and more freedom, more flexibility for your investments.
Hurley, can you quickly throw that ABC thing? I just want to point something out that I think this to me is like the signal. In that second line at the very bottom, it's high risk private equity and cryptocurrency investment. So even though ABC is covering this, I think their feelings about what the broader cryptocurrency market is are still coming out in the language that they're using. And John, I kind of want to reiterate everything that you said. This to me is a sell the news type of event. Like, I had a lot of clients texting me the moment Trump passed this, we saw the price rip up. We got all the way up to like touching 117K. But then we're just kind of like hovering at that point. Look, we saw the ETFs get launched last January, and there are still like traditional financial institutions that don't allow their clients to purchase the ETFs. So I think we're still very, very far away from this actually being implemented broadly in every single 401k. Is going to be a provider by provider, like case by case scenario, more than it's just going to be like, oh, I have a 401k, let me buy Bitcoin with it. And I think that, to your point, John, like, this is a very long term, like, it will be bullish in the short, and I would even say in the medium term. This isn't going to move the needle. It does provide, I think, guidance and a little bit more credibility to Bitcoin. And I think more and more people are going to start to view Bitcoin in particular as, okay, this is a long-term asset. I know it's only been around for 16 years, but you know, if we really want to like break down the nuts and bolts of it, what Google's been publicly traded for like 25 years. It's only it like these types of companies that grow exponentially, or these types of assets that grow exponentially early on. There's, we're all still in the very early stages of a lot of these things. So we, time will tell to see how this gets played out. I'm more interested in seeing, quite frankly, what institutions over the course of the next 6 to 12 months start to come out and say, okay, you can buy with us. You can buy Bitcoin directly with us, more so than whether or not DC is saying, okay, yes, we'll allow Bitcoin to be in your 401k.
That's a good thing to point out, because I personally haven't had one, but I have clients that have 401ks that they're able to get Bitcoin ETF exposure in currently.
Right.
So it already exists, but this should ideally open up the window wider, because there's many. Every 401k I've ever had, it's like, here's 20 investment funds, the JP yep. Morgan, the Vanguard, the Fidelity, pick one, right? And you have no idea what they are or what they do.
I would even say too, like on the other side of it, like for example, Merrill Lynch is the best example. I work with a few different brokers out of Merrill. I have clients who like split. They have an investment account at Merrill, but then they also open up a Swan account with us here because they want the direct Bitcoin exposure, because Merrill cannot buy the ETF on behalf of their clients. They can't answer questions about Bitcoin, even if a client asks them about it, and they surely can't bring Bitcoin up directly to clients. But all the advisors have caught on and they're like, our clients are asking about this. Like, we sound uneducated if we don't at least try to help them or guide them in some direction, some way, shape, or form. But at the same time too, like, the rules from Merrill at large still dictate that. So it's going to be like a case by case scenario for sure.
Totally. Yeah. It's just further legitimizing Bitcoin. I mean, I feel like that's what the last couple of years have been about ever since the ETFs, right? It's like, this is just, I think, jumping off what Q said about things being around for a certain amount of time. It's still only been 16 years. And I think, what is it? The Lindy effect, that says that after 20 years, people's main idea of something is that it's going to be around forever. It's like, right, the internet was solidified after everyone thought it was a passing fad, maybe when it was like 10, 12, 15 years old. Yeah. And I think Bitcoin's kind of in that area where it's just passing that stage of being considered something that's going to go away. And it's something that's going to be here forever. So,
dude, everyone told you to short Amazon stock for the first like 15 years of its existence. Yeah. And like, if you took the other side of that trade, you could have possibly retired by now. So, exactly.
Yeah. Good comments by you guys. Alec, I'm glad you brought up that, you know, the crypto side of this, which I did want to talk about just for a second. Crypto, I think, is taking this news more positively than Bitcoin is. And I will just share as an anecdote that some of my family members, I'm talking like younger cousins and stuff, they know I work in the world of Bitcoin, so they'll bring it up to me. But they did, unfortunately, last weekend, once again, ask me what I think of XRP. And
every time.
It is hard to to be fair, you look at the chart, you know, I think XRP has gone from like $1 to $3, you know, something like that. I don't really watch what it's done. But some people just look at that, and if that's their number go up, right, and they don't know anything about economics, about how these protocols and networks actually work, they're just going to look at it and be like, yeah, this thing was up, you know, 300%. Well, you know, why would I not buy it? You just look at like the past few days or 30-day gains for some of these other crypto tokens, and they are up a lot. Hurley, did you have some line that was like, Bitcoiners always, we think that we're going to get to this point where we have to stop explaining Bitcoin versus crypto, but it's probably going to be like a lifelong task for us.
Yeah, it's just also tiresome. It just keeps coming back. Yeah, it's and I think it comes down to like what you said. It's not even just like, you know, it's people, very smart people, obviously, that just have not pondered it or looked at it from a like monetary history or money perspective, right? Like, I just watched, there was, I think, Natalie Brunell on Fox Business or something. And at the end, both of the anchors were just like, I just still don't get it. I don't get it. But the number goes up. So it must be, it's like, you know what I mean? She's like, you've been right this whole time and you got a nice smile. That's what she says to Natalie. But it's like,
oh my God,
I still don't get it. Right. And it's like, it's because they're not looking at it from the right lens. Right. And I think at the very end, the guy even says, but there's no earnings and there's no, and Natalie's like, well, that's the whole point. Right. Like, so it's, I think people that do, like you say, like buy XRP, or it's like they see that number go up and they're like, you know, or they see the hype. There's a lot of propaganda around XRP and a lot of marketing that they pump out all over the place. They pay certain, you know, crypto places to put out news about their coin going to be pumping and all this. It's going to replace, you know, it's going to replace all these payment rails and all that. So they see that and they're like, oh, XRP is great too. I'm just going to buy that instead of looking at it like, what is money? How is Bitcoin, you know, better money than gold, right? They don't look at it like that. So,
no, I mean, John, I responded to your, like, you sent something about XRP in Slack, and I was like, I literally just had this conversation with my dad about how someone tried to convince my dad that XRP Ripple is going to go to 5,000 a coin. And then my dad was like, so the market cap, you think the market cap of this is going to be worth more than the total market cap of just the stock market? Like, explain your rationale or reasoning there. And then the guy like could not rationalize what my dad was saying. So to your point, I think my conversation, I have plenty of clients who dabble in crypto. And whenever they say anything, I just pull up market caps. I'm like, okay, so what your price point is means the market cap is here. How do you get to this market cap? I don't care about price. Explain this market cap justification. And most people can't.
Your dad sounds based, Q.
A little bit. Don't give him too much credit, though. It'll go straight to his head like John.
It happens to the best of us. Yeah, okay. That's on the more frustrating side. But on the positive side, just one final comment from me on this topic is, and we already have some of this going on with people owning Bitcoin in their IRAs. As Alec pointed out, we do this at Swan. We've been offering this for a long time. We have new people coming in to do it every single day. And it's been legal, totally legal, like not a gray area, not a question mark, totally legal. And politicians touching people's retirement assets is like a political third rail. So the positive here for me is that we already have this like entrenchment of Bitcoin in people's retirement assets. This message is going to all the people that are worried about some draconian government action against Bitcoin in the future. It just becomes really hard for you to be a politician that's like, hey, we're going to slap an onerous tax on Bitcoin, or we're going to, you know, worse, we're going to seize your Bitcoin, you know, anything like that. When people own it in their retirement accounts, and again, now IRAs legal, has been legal for a long time, 401ks, it's really just not been accessible. If the government can open 401ks, and then, you know, let's say 4 years from now, a healthy chunk of people have an allocation of Bitcoin in their 401k, that just makes it incrementally harder for the government to do anything, you know, negative towards Bitcoin.
Can I take the other side of that for a second?
Sure.
So I agree with everything you're saying in the context and a silo of Bitcoin only, but where we stand right now, it's not a Bitcoin only policy. It is a broader crypto policy, and we'll see what cryptocurrencies qualify for this. But if anything happens to one of these other cryptocurrencies, doesn't that almost give the government more incentive to stick their hands in it, get involved, and then turn around and like force the issue on Bitcoin in their own way, despite the fact that it wasn't Bitcoin that did something? But again, we've talked about, we haven't separated Bitcoin from crypto as much as Bitcoiners understand this. The broader public doesn't. The policy is a pro-crypto, not a pro-Bitcoin policy. So then, like, I'm just going to say something stupid, but like, let's say Trump coin gets approved to be part of the 401k. And then some crazy thing happens with Trump coin. Trump's not in office to stop anything. It's like a democratically run, or Dems controlling DC. That opens the door in my eyes to DC taking a very aggressive anti-Bitcoin, anti-crypto stance.
I think that's an important thing. And if anyone watched the strategy earnings call, they brought on a bunch of influential people in the Bitcoin space to talk, and Saylor brought up one of the biggest things he wants to see happen is more regulatory clarity and the framework across the entire space, which I would agree kind of would help set Bitcoin in one space and everything else in their proper slots to help prevent something like that from happening, right? If there is a classification for each type of token, whatever they're claiming to be, you know, have them segmented out so it's not, you know, going to impact Bitcoin. We know what Bitcoin is. That's easily laid out. If these other things have problems, just remove that section and leave the Bitcoin, right? So that's another topic I've seen heavily debated, but I agree there does need to be more walls put up between the different types of things in the crypto space.
I think that's right. And I get the concerns, Q. I would say, you know, anything could happen with future new administrations, and we have to be vigilant and watchful for all that stuff. But I do think there are some positives. Like, I don't think Bitcoin is at any risk of being deemed a security. I think a lot of these other crypto tokens still are. I think we're supposed to see more from the Clarity Act on that. And then I also take it as a positive that, you know, the crypto czar, David Sacks, he has publicly said, this is why Bitcoin is different, like in detail. And he gave a phenomenal answer. So that doesn't mean he's going to be the person calling those shots forever. But I do think there's been a good amount of headway made. So I'm hopeful that Bitcoin will get treated different than all this other stuff going forward. I do believe that there will be crypto offerings in people's 401ks, and some people are unfortunately going to get wrecked with that. But I don't think it will negatively affect Bitcoin too much.
Fair. We'll take a water bet on that.
Yeah. Years and years from now, we can revisit it. All right, cool. Hopefully we don't have to talk about crypto for the rest of the show now. Let's move on to gold. I prefer to talk about gold instead of crypto. We're going to talk about non-Bitcoin topics. So let's hit this next one. So the Federal Reserve has released a paper. It was on August 1st, so about a week ago. But I'll just read what we have highlighted here. So, and the title again for the audio people: Official Reserve Revaluations, the International Experience. And then the very first part of it, which I think is the most important part: with public debt at high levels, some governments have begun to explore financing additional expenditures without raising taxes while also not increasing public debt outstanding. One possibility is using proceeds from valuation gains on gold reserves, as has been floated in the US and Belgium recently. So I think Bitcoiners kind of know about this. And what's really funny here is the footnote, if we can show that one. So yeah, the very first footnote on that section I just read, it shows in the US, the idea has come up in the context of helping to establish a strategic Bitcoin reserve or a sovereign wealth fund. And the use of revaluation proceeds was proposed in recent legislation by Senator Lummis. So Bitcoin people who follow Bitcoin content, this is something you've definitely heard before. In those budget neutral ways to acquire Bitcoin, people like Cynthia Lummis have said, hey, here's one, you can revalue the gold. Which the revalue of the gold, by the way, that's not like, I don't think that's originally a Bitcoin, content idea. I think other people have been talking about this because the gold is valued on the Fed and the Treasury value the gold at like $42 an ounce. And, you know, gold is touching $3,500 an ounce today. I haven't looked at the numbers in a while of what the difference is, but if my memory is correct, I thought it was like around $1 trillion. That of additional money that the Treasury could have. And I want to get your guys' thoughts on this, but just one more comment from me. I feel like not enough people spend time talking about why does this give the Treasury more money to spend, right? Like they don't actually have more money. And
that was almost exactly like, my thought. Yeah.
Almost like money is a made up concept. Yeah, exactly. Please continue.
Effectively, yes. But like the way I like to describe it is, why does this work? Why does this give the Treasury more money to spend? It's because the money that a bank has, the money that the Treasury has, it's ultimately whatever the Fed says you have. That's the money. So the Fed literally just says like, okay, you hold this gold. We've been valuing the gold at $42 an ounce. Let's value it at $3,500. In our books, because we're like the ultimate ledger master, you now have more money. Treasury, you can go spend more money. Like that's, to me, that's just case in point for like this fiat one ledger controlled system. That money is whatever the Fed basically says it is. I don't think that gets talked about enough here, but anyway, takeaways there, gold potentially revalued officially, more money for the treasury to spend, and the Fed itself calling out the strategic Bitcoin reserve, all definitely noteworthy news items here.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, Alec.
I just wanted to share one take I saw. I believe it was Luke Groman, that if you take this valuation, like since the dollar used to be backed by a certain amount of gold, right, through this revaluation, you'd essentially be admitting the actual true inflation rate, because $1 equaled $42, you know, dollars worth of gold. And now just revaluing would say, actually, it's $1 equals $3,300. So I think he put the number like 8.4% CAGR on that inflation rate, which is just mind blowing. Like the inflation numbers are out there.
They're like, they're artificial.
Yeah.
The inflation numbers have long been artificial.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right though. That's like a perfect, encapsulation of what, because I think gold is one of the best ones, right? They say it's like a, what is it? An ounce of gold is like a fine man's suit in like 1901. And now it's the same. Right. So it's like, that is the perfect representation of what inflation actually is. And that's 8% per year. Is that what the CAGR is? 8% every year since then? That's insane. That's wild. And a lot more than the 2% they say, 4X, right?
Yeah. And doesn't that align with like 7% is the walking around number I've always had of like, I think Saifedean has done this, the long-term money supply growth. And this is a little tricky because money supply in total is hard to measure, but like generally speaking, it's been 7% per year.
Yeah.
So gold kind of tracking that does make sense. So the numbers check out, and yes, I think CPI, you know, do I think that they are just fabricating CPI numbers? I don't believe that. I think they are great. This one of the best phrases out there. I think they're massaging the data. They're massaging it in a way that it comes out and it includes things that are beneficial to reducing CPI. You know, it narrowly looks at certain things and excludes other things.
Yeah. Tofu hasn't gone up that much. So let's throw a tofu turkey in the basket.
Well, yeah. That's the thing. It's like CPI, like they artificially came up with this formula that whoever determined this is the best way for us to measure inflation out of this like basket of goods, that some goods are not even regularly used today that otherwise were like other goods that we use regularly today barely carry any weight into the CPI. I think the larger point from this is, again, kind of the joke I made, which is the sad truth of this, to me just continues to signal that money is an artificial construct, and the fact that they could just like tomorrow decide, all right, we're just going to reprice gold because we may have like gotten over our skis a little bit, just further cements and necessitates why we need a form of sound money that is not controlled by any centralized entity. Those are, I think, the signal points. And then of course, you know, I'll never get off this beating horse or whatever the term or phrase is, but would love an audit of our gold storage in Fort Knox.
Yeah.
I think that would be helpful before we make any policy decisions around the price of gold.
That came and went pretty quick, right? Remember that was a hot topic like a couple months, and then it just disappeared.
So did fiscal austerity from this administration. Yeah, so yeah.
Very quickly. Yeah. Yeah, I would just add that you know, with the gold revaluation, it's, I think, I mean, a lot of people have said, and I know this is I think this is Vijay, that what happened there? Well, it looks like we bugged out. Oh no, that's coming in there. Okay, anyways, there was a Vijay tweet about why it's actually in the US's best interest to demonetize gold.
Oh, that did bug out. Sorry, I just clicked what looks like the VJ tweet.
But yeah, the VJ tweet turns out it's turned into our thumbnail, which is
okay.
But yeah, so that it's
doing it live.
It's in their best interest to devalue gold and to obviously to increase the value of Bitcoin, because most people the U.S. by like person and by corporation and by everything holds the most Bitcoin, right? So it's like it really is in their best interests. I don't know if it depends how long it takes them to realize that and if they're actually going to do something about it. But I mean, if this administration is all about, you know, pro US and pro Bitcoin too, pro, then it's like it would seriously be in their best interest, and it would actually be bad for their biggest adversaries like China, right? So yeah, should be interesting to see if they figure that out.
I think that's a too close to the sun take from Vijay. Like, I love Vijay, but I think part of it too is like, you know, all of us are talking our book. The four of us stand to benefit very greatly from hyper-Bitcoinization or from anything that boosts the price of Bitcoin. I still actually think the US needs to like properly set up a Bitcoin strategic reserve, properly start an accumulation process before they take some sort of drastic measure that starts the hyper-Bitcoinization process from a legislative perspective. Because yes, to your point, from a citizen, corporation, and from their own holdings standpoint, they are in the lead. But like just being in the lead, I don't think is going to be enough for the US to maintain global supremacy. It needs to be head and shoulders ahead of the rest of the world.
Hmm. Yeah, one thing to know.
Wait for the buy. You're saying the buy, not because they have the strategic Bitcoin reserve, but they need to start buying.
Yeah, acquiring in some way, shape, or form. Like a bit, like I'm still the worst kept secret in DC is the Bitbond. We're still waiting for that.
Right.
And this, like buying Bitcoin through this strategic reserve, I don't think could be the only use case here, right? And it does state in that report there are six countries that have done this in the past. They've revalued their gold reserves to accomplish different goals, whether it was covering losses from a fall in interest income based on different investments that didn't work out, or other things, right? So if there are policy goals that this administration is looking to accomplish, such as growing the strategic reserve or other things, right, they may use it or they may not. But I would agree there's other geopolitical considerations that are way above my head that I think would play a role. It's definitely an interesting option, though.
Shout out to Bitcoin Policy Institute and Matthew Pines for some super level-headed, like academic takes on this. They have a 47-page paper that I just pulled up because you guys made me think of it. A Global Economic Reordering, U.S.-China Competition, and Bitcoin as a Tool of U.S. Statecraft. And they specifically called it report prepared for Scott Bessent, Secretary Designate. This is before he got sworn in, of the Treasury. And this was, I don't know if they have a date on it actually, but it must have been, you know, whatever, November, December last year. I just did control F on this one for the word gold, not Bitcoin. And there's 65 examples of the word gold, which I think is very illustrative. Like, you can't talk about this without talking about the history of money, what gold has served as, what we think Bitcoin will serve as going forward. And there, anyone who wants to like really dig in on this topic with, you know, Alec, I think your point is fair. These are not real, like the geopolitical implications of this are not things that the four of us are thinking about all the time. None of us have a DC background as far as I'm aware. Q may have worked for the CIA at one point. It's unclear, but other than that,
who said at some point, still do.
His name is Q, so yeah,
some sort of secret agent. If anyone really wants to dive into this, I would shout out the Bitcoin Policy guys, Matthew Pines in particular. They've just written a ton of stuff on this, so you can dive in at your leisure. All right, let's move on.
Wait, real quick, because I'm going to say this faster. I think you should do the plug right now after that illustrious conversation about DC.
You know what? Let's do it. We're going to do it live. So BTC in DC, if you guys are not aware, this is a conference that's going to be happening September 30th and October 1st, or 30 days in September, right? September 30th and October 1st. So if I will expect to be there myself, as will a lot of people from Swan. So if you're looking into Bitcoin policy and adoption in the US, this is definitely the event for you. There's going to be Bitcoiners, lawmakers, thought leaders. I love that we have thought leaders in there. Goldman Sachs loves the term thought leaders. And it will be in the heart of Washington in DC, where all these people are. So you can literally meet the people who are shaping Bitcoin's future in the place where laws are made, you know, Capitol Hill. btcndc.com. Swan will get you 10% off your ticket as a promo code. And yeah, check that out if you want to go. Since John is doing ad reads here, we're going to continue with this. Also, I'm going to shout out Mara, the world's largest publicly traded Bitcoin miner. They support this show and they help make Bitcoin the world's most decentralized and most secure monetary network.
Good instincts, Q. And John, you are the definition of a thought leader. So
I was about to say, I think the thought leader is all the podcasters that will be there.
Correct. Correct. Podcast, Bitcoin podcaster and thought leader, basically synonyms.
Yes. Yeah. Or said another way, future Bitcoin treasury leaders, treasury company leaders.
Influencer. Yeah. Okay. So I think we do have a kind of a logical run of show here. The next thing we wanted to talk about after gold potential revaluation to give the treasury some extra money to spend is these headlines around gold tariffs. And we have a little clip, I think it's from this morning, Saylor talking on Bloomberg, just to give a little background here. So there's headlines about gold having a pretty hefty, like 30-40% tariff issued by the US. So gold coming into the US. That kind of confused me at first, because I would have thought that the US wants gold to flow into the country. It is the longest running monetary asset, decentralized monetary asset. Even if you think Bitcoin's the future, you probably don't want to give up all your gold unless you have some 3D chess strategy going on there. Then Q informed us that there was another headline today that the White House said, no, we're actually exempting this. That was bad information yesterday. So I'm not exactly sure where the actual tariff policy on gold stands. I think it'll probably get cleared up today or next week. But that's the background. And Saylor had some good comments on the idea of Bitcoin getting tariffed. And that's the next clip we have here.
Hopefully this actually plays. Let's see.
Let's hope.
On some of the other big news from today, a lot has certainly happened on this Friday, but one of those is what's going on in the gold market right now. You have the Trump administration ruling that gold bars will be subject to tariffs as well, these reciprocal tariffs. So imports of gold will be tariffed. And that's really sending shockwaves through the gold ecosystem. Gold and Bitcoin are also often compared to one another. Bitcoin called digital gold, for example. I wonder if you think this has any ripple effects, positive or negative, for Bitcoin?
It does. Bitcoin is digital gold. It's going to accelerate the migration of capital from physical gold to digital gold. Bitcoin lives in cyberspace, no tariffs in cyberspace. The big appeal of Bitcoin is it's not physical. It doesn't have weight. You can settle anywhere with anybody in a few minutes. And so gold has always been too heavy, too slow, and you can't really ship it across an ocean. And if you do, now you're getting tariffs. So I really think it just reminds everybody why the digital version of gold is better than actual physical gold. And I think it's going to catalyze a new wave of institutional adoption of Bitcoin.
All right. Crypto is stateless. It's hard to tariff. Michael, have to leave it there. Really enjoyed speaking with.
Well said by Saylor, as usual. I'll let you guys chime in on this, but big observation for me, I just have to comment on the fact that Bloomberg, I view Bloomberg and CNBC as the two biggest financial media platforms out there. Just the fact that they like have to have these conversations about Bitcoin now, and the anchors have to be at least somewhat educated on Bitcoin, is always amazing to me. So I think we'll just continue to see that in the future. But any comments from you guys on the gold tariff stuff and the Saylor comments?
Yeah, I love it. The only issue I have is the anchor at the end saying crypto is stateless. Crypto is, in fact, not stateless. There are companies and people at the head of these things that are at the helm of legislation, laws, and governance. So Bitcoin is the only network that can't be governed in that fashion. But Saylor looks, he's crushing it. I can't imagine. He looks so relaxed. He's so happy. He knows he's going to win. His company's acquired so much Bitcoin. I love seeing him out there educating as much as he is. And yeah, whether the tariff is just a lever for a trade deal. I know there's a lot of that been going on with these tariffs, but it is just that proof that, look, you cannot put a tariff. You can't control this thing that, you know, moves across cyberspace. It's just another proof of use case.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people I find still kind of use the non-physical nature of Bitcoin as a negative, but this is a perfect example. And there's so many more, right? Obviously people think about just anything that you digitize, like music and files and all that kind of stuff and movies. And there's benefits to things not being physical, obviously. And this is a huge one for Bitcoin. I think that's the main thing. Even if there's tariffs are not on gold, you can't tariff Bitcoin. It's impossible. So that's huge.
Yeah. I kind of take this as I kind of brought up, I feel like by next week, the entire tariff gold bar thing is like completely taken a 180. I don't think this is like out of the realm of the Trump administration. Like when in the early days they were like, all right, we're tariffing everyone 100% and this is what we're going to do in my terrible Trump voice. And then all of a sudden it was like backtracked. I saw the best take, because like I've never read The Art of the Deal. I've got better things to read. But like someone on Twitter like detailed this, and they're like, this is Trump's negotiating tactic. He says something super outlandish, not expecting to get it, and then will like slowly backtrack to like a middle ground that is still in his favor, but further away from where he started. So it looks like, you know, I've accommodated everyone involved. I think this is like the step one of this process, and where we end will be very interesting. I agree on the notion of you can't tariff something digital, but you know, you can implement more taxes on it. You can tax people who hold it in their IRAs. All of a sudden you can tax the miners differently. Like there are other ways I could see DC. Like again, Uncle Sam has to get his cut. Like sadly, unfortunately, death taxes, and those are here forever for now. So there will be other ways. I think DC will stick their hands into Bitcoin.
I also have to point out that the anchor said something about ripple effects, and I shuddered because I thought she was talking about XRP. Thankfully she wasn't. But I also think it's cool that like this is kind of getting into the economics of Bitcoin, which for me has always been the most fascinating part. You know, some people come to Bitcoin for number go up. Some people come because they're a computer science major. They love the tech. That wasn't me. Some people come because of like the human rights element. I think that's awesome, but that wasn't the primary one for me. Some people come because of the energy aspects of Bitcoin. Again, that wasn't the primary for me. For me, it was the economic side. And I do like the fact that Saylor's up there kind of forcing this conversation, being like, he didn't say it in these words, but this is the implication. It's like, yeah, gold was money. And then it basically failed as being money because it was not portable enough. We digitized gold because it was not serving a good role as money. Like that process already played out. So now he's just pointing out like, yes, now we have this digital version of gold and it's way better for these reasons. I just love that this conversation is happening on Bloomberg.
I also want to just quickly, because we're bashing a lot of the reporters today, I want to shout out one mainstream journalist, Mackenzie Sigalos over at CNBC, who has for years covered Bitcoin and crypto, who understands the difference between Bitcoin and crypto, has done an incredible job, and to the best of her abilities, of educating her colleagues as well as just, again, the CNBC audience. So like 99% of these reporters are still stuck in this like crypto land, but do want to just give credit where credit is due to one reporter.
Thank you for adding a little balance there. That was worth it. All right, cool. Let's keep going, because we probably have what, really 10 more minutes left ish.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, let's hit some of these. There definitely are a few more headlines we want to make everyone aware of here. Next one is a post from Eric Balkunas at Bloomberg about the basically the different types of markets it seems like we've been in since the Bitcoin ETFs launched. And shout out Mitch Askew at Blockware. He had a great post on this a month or two ago where he highlighted the same thing. And Eric Balkunas agreed with him then. So basically what this is getting at is Bitcoin's volatility has come down. It has come down significantly post the ETFs. And that kind of does make sense. You just gave people and institutions a vehicle to trade, buy and hold or trade these vehicles much more easily than they could in the past, and do it in what's likely a compliant way for them, whereas holding spot Bitcoin may not have been compliant for many entities out there. So just to read this, the 90-day rolling volatility for Bitcoin is below 40 for the first time. And it was 60 when the ETFs launched. And in this chart, Eric from Bloomberg throws in GLD, gold, the gold ETF, for perspective. And it looks like it's 22. So he points out that Bitcoin's rolling 90-day vol is now less than 2x that of gold, whereas it used to be over 3x that of gold. And in some ways, I don't think this is really shocking. I mean, you guys tell me what you think, but I think most Bitcoiners have had the view that, yeah, Bitcoin's vol from either the early days or 2017, 21, 22 was not going to continue going forward. Like, if the Bitcoin thesis plays out, it does need to be a more institutionalized asset class, and it's not going to be as volatile. But we wanted to put that out and actually put some numbers around it, because that thesis is playing out.
Totally. Yeah, I think it plays right in. I think Balkunas has also commented a lot on almost kind of like agreeing with some Bitcoiners talking about this cycle being different because of the dampened volatility after the ETFs and the demand and the new buyers and stuff like that. So I think it's I think it's legitimate. And then I think it's a good segue that we can get into this, because we only got a little bit of time left. But the Checkmatey had a good report this week about,
yeah, pull it up. Perfect.
About there being, you know, we're at a point, kind of this point of no return. Well, not point of no return, but we're in this kind of interesting, he calls it a danger zone, that in other cycles, 500 days after the halving is when we usually go parabolic. And we've had such a, you know, kind of just stair step, kind of boring kind of price action. I mean, it hasn't been boring, but we've gone up a huge amount in the past couple of years, but it's been very, you know, it's kind of like been very gradual and slow and dampened volatility. So he's saying it's either, you know, either the cycle is going to break in the next, you know, 25, 26 days or a few months, and we're just going to continue this pattern, or, you know, or in the next couple of days, we're going to go parabolic, right? He's also brings a good case about how volatility is really coiled up. So there's a good case that we could see major volatility up or down in the next few months. So I think it's interesting to talk about, kind of, we're in a very interesting time in this cycle, and just for Bitcoin in general. It's like, is the 4-year cycle going to hold? And we should be learning that in the next couple months of what's going to happen, right?
That's a great graphic you just showed there, Hurley. It is, it does seem like pretty soon we will be able to say whether Bitcoin is behaving distinctly differently from prior cycles. And I'm more in the camp that it is going to be different. I think that chart, you know, more of a slow and steady cycle, it looks like it's what it's going to be going forward.
Yeah. People are gun shy about this time is different, because last cycle, everyone was saying that, and everyone got, you know, had to put their foot in their mouth. But honestly, if you look at just the cycle from the beginning, this cycle has been different from the beginning. Like, we hit the all-time high before the halving for the first time, the price action, the volatility, the buyers. So we'll see what happens. No one's going to come out and make a bet on it here, I don't think. But it seems like this time is different, especially too, like the rate cuts. I think you mentioned as well all the previous two bear markets, 2018, 2022, we were in high interest rate or low interest rate environments, right? Now we're at peak interest rates right now. And this feeds into this. There's 93% chance that we're going to have, you know, the Federal Reserve is going to cut interest rates in September. And that's the first of expected to be many interest rate cuts. So that's also bullish. So lots of stuff.
I want to bring this up, because I had this conversation with my brother yesterday, because I've been sort of like playing around with this thought in my head for a while, but like, the market tends to go towards maximum pain, and maximum pain, in my opinion, is starting to look more and more like we've reached the top. And like, you know, theoretically, everyone expecting Bitcoin to go higher, the market should go to the other direction. But Hurley, to your point, I think that's the signal that I'm paying attention to, is the fact that during the last two run-ups, you saw interest rates being cut or super low. You saw new money entering the broader market, so liquidity was much higher. And then those contractions happened during rate hikes, during market downturns. I think the interesting thing, if that plays out, the narrative of Bitcoin being a hedge against inflation, it still hasn't sort of, it won't have separated from the general market if it still sort of is marching along the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 just at a higher clip. But I do think, to John's point, that if we do see, you know, this time being different and the volatility decreasing and we're less in that like moonshot ability and we're just like slowly and steadily climbing higher and higher, that steadiness should give more of an appetite to new investors, because that fear of that 80%, 75% drawdown starts to get diminished. This becomes a more steadily growing asset, and you could theoretically see more money and more new money, more new entrants starting to look at Bitcoin as a legitimate store of value. Even though everyone watching this already sees that, again, like, we're all very close to the sun, we see that, but like, step outside, 95% of the people that you interact with have no interest or knowledge of Bitcoin still.
Yep.
I mean,
go ahead, Alc.
I think I agree with your Max Payne argument, Q. The only thing I struggle to see is, sure, there's a few people that are overly bullish, but it doesn't seem like that's the general consensus. You know, last cycle, nobody, like, 100K was in the bag, no matter who you asked, right? But at this point, it seems like everyone's determination is so split. And the fact that retail's not, you know, jumping on board, they think Bitcoin is too expensive. So, I mean, the Max Payne event could be continuing higher as well. So, I mean, there's two sides to the argument. I definitely don't take a side and want to watch this play out. I'm happy either way to stack some more sats cheaper or to watch it moon, right? I'm happy either way.
Yeah, and if you're right that we've hit a top, this would be the first cycle ever where there's no mania, there's no FOMO at all, because as you said, Alec, there has been none. Like, it's been very muted. As far as, you know, even just text messages, I think my mind peaked around Christmas a little bit. I got a few text messages about it passing 100K, but since then it's been very quiet. So either way, that would be a break in the cycle, right? But another point I think CheckMeaty brought up that was interesting was that the people that are buying now, a lot of them are buying through ETFs, right? Institutions. So all they've seen is the IBIT chart. So they don't even really, it's not like they can zoom out and say, oh, it like dipped down 80%, because IBIT never did that. So their idea of this asset is just like, boop, just keeps going up. I thought that was interesting. I mean, people can obviously research Bitcoin and see the chart and probably generally know that it has drawdowns, but I thought that was an interesting like tidbit, that a lot of people that are buying now don't particularly, like, they're looking in the last year and a half or whatever it's been since the ETFs, and they're not exactly expecting or looking at there to be a huge drawdown like there has been in the past.
That's actually an incredible point. I've never once looked at just the IBIT chart.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look just like the IBIT, right? Chart. That's crazy.
Even my brother, who knows about Bitcoin, he just talks about IBIT, because I guess that's how he holds his Bitcoin now. He used to have self-custody, but he buys the ETF or whatever. So it's like, I think a lot of people do think about like that, because it's the easiest, most accessible way for them to buy it. They don't have to worry about self-custody, right? The people that haven't done the work like we have to understand why you'd want to have self-custody, but yeah.
That's very interesting. Yeah, all those people that are just ETF have a completely different view. That's wild.
Something to think about.
Should we hit the Richard Werner stuff, and then we'll end with this great book, Praising Fiat Money?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Let's just play the Werner clip. He talked with Tucker Carlson, but I won't set it up too much here. You guys will check it out in the clip.
Banks are not financial intermediaries. Banks are special. They have a unique power that no other player in the economy has, and that is the power to create money. When you get a loan, no money is transferred to it's transferred away from anywhere else. And you just credited new money out of nothing that is not transferred away anywhere inside or outside the bank, which seems, you know, quite sort of extreme.
Like magic.
In fact, one uses, the convention is to use Latin for this. The money is created ex nihilo, out of nothing.
Just to be clear, not just central banks.
Any bank. In fact, that's the whole point. We're talking about normal banks. With central banks, it wouldn't be a surprise.
But the Bank of Omaha can
yes.
just...
any bank creates money. When you take out a loan, the money that you're given as the borrower didn't previously exist. It is net new purchasing power that is being created and added to the money supply. And that's how the system works.
Okay, so anyone who follows me on Twitter, I put out a bunch of tweets on this episode. I thought it was totally bizarre. I think the clip that Hurley just showed, and there was a really good Swan thread on this, which Werner himself quote tweeted and sent out. The Swan thread does a great job of highlighting the things Werner said that would resonate with Bitcoiners. It was like almost like sound money advocacy is how it came across. But he said a bunch of other things that were super confusing. He refers to banks creating money as fraud. But then on the other hand, he's like, oh, but we also need it. And it's like the best tool for achieving economic growth. Tucker didn't, you know, generally, I think Tucker does a good job interviewing. I don't think this is a topic that Tucker understands well. That was another takeaway for me, is like Tucker, you know, is very good in other areas. He did not really have the ability to like ask Werner the proper follow-up questions. So just like another person who has not really thought about the history of money and the nature of money. So none of them talked about like how something fraudulent could be so critical for economic growth. In another clip, Werner makes a linkage between central banking and waging war. Most Bitcoiners would be like, yeah, that linkage does exist. But then at another point in the interview, Werner talks about how the Fed during the GFC bought up a bunch of assets. And Tucker, to his credit, goes like, we call that a bank bailout in this country. And Werner goes, no, 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 that happens at no cost to society. And it was fair because the Fed paid for it. And then unfortunately, Tucker was just like, okay, sure. And they like moved on to the next topic. And then there was this other like econ point that I just wince at every time I hear it. Werner repeated this thing that like MMTers say and the Euro dollar bros say this, that the Fed does not create money and that only banks create money. I'm not going to get into that one. That's been debated by many people, including Lynn has written about this, why that's kind of a nonsensical claim. But anyway, this was a super bizarre interview to me. Usually you don't see one person making all those claims, right? Like usually it's one person making some of them. I left so confused as to what this guy, Richard Werner, actually believes. And then lastly, just to throw like a little tinfoil hatty stuff, he's got like 3 Twitter accounts also, Richard Werner. Like this guy's a bit of an enigma. I still am left scratching my head with this whole interview.
Yeah, and like you said, he retweeted the post from that we had of the thread about that interview. He said, what did he say? It's like my interview from a Bitcoiner's perspective or something. But then I think this was from 2024, which I think kind of, makes his point. He comes across a little bit less impressive when you see his stance on Bitcoin. He basically says, because Satoshi he's got that whole tinfoil hat. Speaking of tinfoil hat, it was created by the CIA because Satoshi Nakamoto means central intelligence in Japanese. Like as if the CIA would purposely do that and like make it that obvious. Oh, we're just going to make the name the CIA in Japanese. Like it's such a silly thing. And if you did any research on Bitcoin, you realize even if it was the CIA, it doesn't matter.
Right. But also I wouldn't put it past the CIA to do something so just moronic as that.
Well, you're on the payroll, so
I cannot confirm or deny these claims that my larger paycheck paying company did or did not create Bitcoin.
All right, we're going to wrap up the show. We're past an hour here, but let's just talk about this book because it's literally like a book praising fiat money. So we have to talk about this.
Yeah, maybe it was written by Werner. I don't know. No, it's not. It's David Williams. I'd never heard of this until I saw someone post that they saw in the airport.
Same. Never heard of the guy. I looked him up on Twitter just because I saw it in the last 24 hours. And this guy has like 330,000 Twitter followers or something. So obviously he's got a pretty big follower base. And then the next screenshot, we won't even show it. But if anyone wants to pause the video, if you're on YouTube, you can pause it there. He's basically praising fiat and saying it's the most significant innovation in money since the Lydians minted their first gold coins. And he then just gives GDP statistics to say since the fiat era, GDP has been higher. And that's his like great argument for why fiat currency is, you know, the best, and it's brought us unprecedented levels of growth. I mean, just a super low IQ argument, to be honest with you. But I mean, I will just say this is why Bitcoin education and Bitcoin advocacy is important. Because there's going to be people who scoop up this book and think like, oh, look at this economist. I'm being educated on economics here. And they're just going to get complete nonsense about the history of money. Yeah. So
total propaganda. And also, yeah, it also just like, because I think the biggest point from that Werner interview that I think was important for him to mention was fiat currencies, being tightly tied to war. And I remember that when I went down the rabbit hole reading the Bitcoin Standard, that was the biggest mind-blowing moment for me. Was realizing that forever wars and since World War One were so tied to the printing of money and having no recourse from that. Because before that, it was like once the population didn't want to buy your bonds anymore, they didn't want the war to happen, it had to end. You know, it was more up to the people if they wanted to fight this war. And after that, we've had these endless wars, Vietnam and the two Iraq wars and both world wars funded by money printing. So I think that was just like. And of course, this book doesn't get into any of that, right? It doesn't seem like it. So
financial fraud is the best economic invention.
Yeah,
apparently.
I think again, this goes back to this idea that like we're still very early in this whole game. The general public has a hard time, especially like, okay, 1971 was what, 74 years ago? So like, and let's extrapolate that out. So you had to be 90. You have to be 90 years old, roughly. In that
54 years.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I think your maths were off on that.
Oh yeah, you're right. Sorry. Okay, so you got to be in your 70s to like not only have like watched us go off the gold standard, but like really remember it potentially and like feel those effects. And for the majority of the population, like you have no memory of what that world looked like. So it's hard to fathom or understand that. You know, money changes over time, and we're just in that moment where it's changing, and it's really hard to grasp that. And then the last thing I'll say about this is like, there's an old data science sort of idea around like when you build out these types of models, when you put garbage data into the model, you're going to get a garbage model out. So like, yeah, when you put garbage fiat money into a measurement of GDP growth, which is tied to garbage fiat, it's going to look good, but in reality, it's garbage on both sides of this. So we started the show kind of talking about, you know, gold being a good proxy for inflation. I would be very curious to see what those GDP numbers would actually look like, those GDP growth numbers that are used in the book, if they're measured actually against gold prices. And then all of a sudden we can really see how much did GDP really grow, or was that just artificial growth?
100%.
Totally.
I think the one thing that one analogy I like to use for people when I'm explaining Bitcoin is like, if you understand how great the gold standard was and why, you know, fiat had to come in to make the portability and speed faster, Bitcoin just does both of those things. So, you know, all the things you love about fiat and all the things you love about gold, there's Bitcoin for you.
Yeah.
Without the fraud.
Good place to end it. Thanks everybody for sticking with us. This was a fun show as usual. I'll ask you guys, am I forgetting anything closing out? I think we just wrapped it here.
We did it. The Q had that perfect segue for the ad reads midway. So we're good.
Well now Alex started it. John, you should also do a quick little Swan private shill.
I will do a short one since we're hour 10 here, but yeah, Swan private in a nutshell, think a private banker and a wealth advisor for everything related to Bitcoin. You get white glove service. You have a person to contact right away. We can help with things like if you have just an issue with your account, finding where to click, we can help you out. You won't be stressing about that. We can also help with much more strategic things, giving guidance on Bitcoin in retirement accounts, custody considerations, multi-sig collaborative custody. We have Swan Vault for that. Inheritance planning. Huge topic when it comes to Bitcoin, getting loans against your Bitcoin, much, much more. So check out Swan Private if you're interested in kind of getting this broad array of services, as well as that white glove treatment. Hurley is obviously on the content side of Swan. You know that from his videos, but Q, Alec, and myself, we're all on the Swan Private side. So we're the ones that spend, you know, 90%+ of our week interacting with clients. And come check us out on the Swan website. Shoot any of us a DM on Twitter if you're hearing this and you want to learn more, and we'd be happy to talk with you. All right, let's wrap it there. Thank you, everyone, for sticking with us on a summer Friday. Hope you guys enjoy August, and we will catch you guys next Friday when Brady is back.
Have a good weekend, guys.
See y'all.
Hey, everybody.